Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Patricia Hotel has occupied the corner of Dunleavy and Hastings of the Vancouver East Side for over 100 years. Its lifespan approaches that of Vancouver itself. The surrounding Strathcona neighborhood grew alongside the hotel and has supplied some of the city's richest history. A wealth of culture moved along those streets and through the corridors of the hotel. People's lives pulsed through the building's arteries and spilled out into the world. The building has weathered the Vancouver rains and the neighborhood's mounting social struggles. It continues to provide affordable lodging to travelers in one of the world's least affordable cities, and supports local performers who would otherwise go unnoticed. The story of the hotel begins where the story of old Vancouver ends, because new Vancouver could only rise after old Vancouver burned. James Johnston is an East Vancouver House researcher and historian.
On June 13, 1886, there was a big wind that came up and a stump fire spread to some other debris, and the wind was going in the right direction, or the wrong direction, I guess, for the city of Vancouver. And in 40 minutes, the new city of Vancouver basically exploded. They said that Vancouver didn't actually burn down. It actually exploded and was consumed in 40 minutes.
Lonnie Resworm is an East Vancouver resident and local historian.
When the fire came, it pretty much cleared out all these rickety, you know, shacks that were thrown up. And so when they rebuilt, which the rebuilding started right away, and it was sort of gave them a clean slate to build what the developers assumed would be like this major West Coast metropolis.
Construction on what would become the Patricia Hotel began in 1910. Originally intended as a doctor's office, the founder of the building, Dr. Thomas Wilson, would not survive to see its completion. The property was acquired by Edward Mulhern, who converted the space into a hotel and opened for business in the summer of 1913. The city had become the modern metropolis predicted by the developers. The railway was bringing in new residents, and the historic Hastings Mill, located a few minutes' walk from the Patricia Hotel, was supplying work to loggers from all over the world.
There's an ad from a 1913 News Herald that talks about it being a new popular priced hotel, and that they advertised it as being two blocks from City Hall. Perhaps that was a draw. It was trying to say that it was really in the center of the happening part of Vancouver.
The typical tenant would be a logger who works out in logging camps most of the year, and then he makes a bunch of money and he comes to Vancouver to spend the winter and blow this wad of cash in his pocket on booze and women and whatever else he's into. Yeah.
They were out to sow their wild oats, to have fun, to maybe have a little bit of a dust up with whoever, but it was to get rid of all the stress, the accumulated stress of living in very, very primitive, cold conditions out in the wild. And so it would have been a rather interesting mix of customers in the Patricia Hotel at that time.
By 1917, Hastings Street had become a swinging entertainment district. The Patricia Hotel opened a cabaret under the title Patricia Cafe, later renamed Pat's Pub. Ada Bricktop Smith, the nightclub queen of Europe, was singing, dancing, and dodging loggers at the hotel before her move to Paris. In her memoirs, Bricktop by Bricktop, she recounts a particularly rowdy New Year's Eve at the cafe.
No one knows what the fight was all about. Everybody was beating up on everybody else. Bowman's was a large place. I remember all the fists flying and glass breaking, but that's all I remember. It was one of those special occasions when I lost count of how many drinks I've had. Next thing I knew, I was in the bed in a white room. My right leg was in a splint and my head felt as if it was about to come off. I was in a hospital and my leg was broken. A gal I knew called Dago was standing by the side of the bed. I couldn't believe it when she told me that I kept trying to get into the brawl the night before. You kept running in the middle of all those punches and someone kept pushing you back out, but that didn't stop you. You got right back in the middle of it again and you got pushed out again, but this time you fell down a flight of stairs. She told me I'd been given quite a time to the doctor who tried to set my leg. He'd just come from a party and was feeling no pain himself. We must have been quite the pair. I rolled and turned so violently that I broke 3 splints. He hadn't been too drunk to do his job, though. My leg healed in a normal length of time and never gave me a bit of trouble. I never told my mama what really happened, just in case she happened to hear something through the grapevine. I wrote and said that I'd sprained my ankle.
My name is Richter, raised in a lion's den, and my nightly occupation is stealing other women's men.
Ada Bricktop Smith, she was a singer and dancer with the Patricia Orchestra, and another one is Jelly Roll Morton. He's probably the most famous guy who played there.
Jelly Roll Morton played the piano for me.
He used to bill himself as the originator of jazz. Both of their descriptions of the Patricia in Vancouver at the time was that, yeah, the audiences didn't really get it.
James Dandifer is a Vancouver-based composer and jazz clarinetist.
What? I'm from here. I've been playing Jelly Roll Morton's music, and I didn't know that he lived in Vancouver and that he worked at Pat's Pub, which is, you know, obviously still standing.
There was this idea, I guess, like a slippery slope kind of tendency in terms of morality, where you starts out with going into a place for, you know, drinking a little beverage, and then music comes on, and then especially with like this crazy jazz music, it's like becomes a little bit sexual maybe.
Jazz originally was jazz, J-A-S-S, which was slang for sex. That kind of keys you into what this music meant at the time. It was really passionate, exciting, and sexy.
It was the leading edge of music at the time, and people responded to it in the same way that people responded to rock and punk now. And it had its fans, and it had its people who didn't like it.
Ain't nobody dead. Somebody must be dead drunk. Don't tell me, I think it's a funeral. Say, look here, people, I do hear a funeral. People hear that trombone phone.
The greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange and market prices.
Provide health care for every man, woman, and child.
How far would you go with that? How far would you extend that?
Just watch it.
No, I've got cancer in my lungs.
Meat pepper, I put it on my plate.
Something set on fire in downtown Vancouver. Some windows broken in office buildings. Riot police have been deployed trying to control...
A century later, Vancouver has hardened. The roads are all paved now, and the structures lining them are formed from rebar and concrete. The neighborhood around the hotel has descended into unyielding poverty, while the bourgeoisie sit poised in trendy shops around its perimeter. The Patricia Hotel continues to serve underfunded travelers, and in the evening, showcases local performers in the same room where Jelly Roll and Ada shook the walls. For the past decade, East Vancouver has hosted an inspired musical moment, which prowled through the venues on Hastings Street. Shearing sonics and daring performances are on offer as young musicians express themselves and grasped for things out of reach. Their vibrations often left to mingle with those of Ada and Jelly Roll in the brick walls of Pat's Pub. Ryan Dick is a local record label owner and musician.
I don't know if Pat's is really in an entertainment district anymore. I mean, closer to Gastown, I've definitely noticed there's a lot more clubs and a lot more, like, normal people coming in from the suburbs to go, you know, do whatever normal people do on a Friday night, which is kind of nice because you don't have to deal with suburbanites for the most part.
Adrian Burris is a musician based in Vancouver.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely one of the venues that was plugged into what was happening in the music scene. Like, it was a safe place, it was fun, it was, you know, easy to get a show there, there was always shows happening.
Vancouver at that point was well known for, like, cutesy indie pop stuff, and then all these bands started that were making pretty noisy punk music, which, so it was pretty exciting, it was really fun.
I definitely wanted in, and I definitely wanted to be part of what I thought was really progressive and interesting music.
Music Waste is a local music festival, and we try to focus on new new artists every year. Yeah, Pat's has always been really supportive of Music Waste. They always are happy to give us the days, and there's been some pretty fun shows there.
I've never really felt unsafe in the Hastings area. You know, I've been attacked in Surrey, but not on Hastings. People look out for each other down here, and they care about each other, and yeah.
Richard Peterson and Deborah Adams stayed in the Patricia Hotel in the summer of 2014.
We arrived in Vancouver a warm July afternoon. I had booked a room at the Patricia Hotel. The area where the hotel stands is one of the most infamous in Vancouver. Everyone knows that East Hastings is a place you will die instantly. A hotel on Hastings is one where the doors won't lock, the faucets will drip, and the door to the bathroom will be lightweight with a minimum 2-inch gap at the bottom. An adventure. Deborah wasn't so sure. Her tropical vacation a few months earlier had been loaded. Love and the idea of forever was on my mind. The place was going to be perfect, and it wasn't. Something didn't feel right. It was the turning point. The Patricia has a great location. Eat some baozi from Chinatown, or the most trendy burger at that upstairs place down Main. The hotel is old. It's great. Instantly transported to my grandmother's house. The counter guy was efficient and so very concerned with who came first. We came first. He reached across the counter and hit the elevator button for us. How pleasant. Some real old-timey service. All food and beer with friends that evening. Things were chatty and enjoyable. Deborah mentioned the thing. It was our big argument before we left China. I was a little drunk and said something that could have been sexy, but ended up not so. I could see she wanted to tell the story. I was slightly opposed. When I returned from the bathroom, the secret had been kept, and for the rest of my trip, I was swamped by questions unanswered. Deborah was tired, but I had decided long ago that I would go to a concert that evening. I was racked with guilt and trying to make up for the approved activity for that evening. Offering to go back with her and then come back, though, it was clear I didn't want to. I believe the words were, "You're acting like a douche." I was. She was fine. I returned to the hotel at 2 a.m. and joined a sleeping Deborah in the soft bed. A couple days later, my friends were invited to our room in the early morning in order to stage a walking adventure through town. We were four now, and the room tightened accordingly. Below, a woman yelled profanity into the void. A bus pushed into a lane. My friends commented on the strange bathroom layout. Deborah remarked how she could take a dump and put her feet up on the bed at the same time. On our way to the lobby, my buddy and I bolted down the stairs. Century-old floorboards thundered. Deborah and Larry took the elevator. After a day of fun in the sun, Deborah was a little tired of hanging with people she didn't really know and wanted alone time. A decision to flee was made as the sun slipped away. No guilt tonight. Cab ride got us back to the open arms of Pat's Pub and the last hours of Jazz Fest. Gentle music flowed out of the fire exit where we smoked frequently, a behavior seemingly out of fashion around most of Vancouver. The neighborhood around the Patricia Hotel isn't particularly fashionable, however. Our smokes were in high demand. Deborah was flying out the next day, but I was staying behind, leaving the Patricia for my friend's couch. Deborah and I said a goodbye that lingered, one of our last. My buddy picked us up at the hotel and drove us to Waterfront Station for a last-minute stroll before the airport. On the way to my friend's place, we drove past the Patricia. It may just be where all roads in Vancouver lead, the kidney of the city. It was sunny.
Most recently, the Patricia Hotel has reclaimed its musical roots and established itself as one of Vancouver's premium jazz venues. Several days a week, local performers take charge of the stage and aspire to have their tones connect with listeners.
As a jazz musician in Vancouver, knowing that one of the geniuses of jazz music played there, that really affects the feel of the place. The first time I walked through those doors, I just felt this connection to the past. I felt like this sort of, I was just sort of awestruck. Like this is where it happened, you know. And so I know as a performer, I feel there's a certain energy there that that comes from knowing what the past was.
James Dandifer continues to perform in Vancouver and can be reached at jamesdandifer.com. Adrian Burris performs as Adrian Teacher with his latest group, The Subs. Ryan Dick continues to support essential local talent with his record label, Hockey Dad Records. Lonnie Russworm's book, Vancouver Was Awesome, can be found at your local bookstore and library. And James Johnstone hosts walking tours of historic Vancouver neighborhoods and can be reached at historywalksinvancouver.blogspot.ca. Produced with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
This is Bird Note. Cackling geese may look a lot like Canada geese, but their slighter build and shorter beaks give them away as a distinct species. And one subspecies in particular has a very special story. Aleutian cackling geese build their nests on a chain of islands off the western coast of Alaska. In the 1700s, fur traders introduced an invasive species of fox to the islands, with devastating consequences for the geese. For decades, Aleutian cackling geese were believed to be extinct. But in the 1960s, a biologist discovered a group of around 300 birds nesting on Boldeer Island. The fortuitous discovery allowed conservationists to put the birds on the endangered species list. And this paved the way for federal protections on their Alaskan nesting grounds and their wintering territories in Oregon and California. Thanks to this habitat conservation, there are now more than 120,000 Aleutian cackling geese, making the biannual journey between Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. To learn how to conserve seasonal habitats and protect the future of migratory birds in your area, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
Spend all my money on you. Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. One of the clearest signs of how climate change is affecting birds is how many migratory birds are arriving earlier in the spring than they did in years past. We know this thanks to dedicated bird banders that catch birds every year, note down the first arrival dates for each species, and place ID bands on birds' legs to keep track of them throughout their lives. But surprisingly, the effect on arrival time is different for members of the same species. Male birds are changing their arrival dates faster than females in many species of birds that breed in North America. It's long been the case that male songbirds arrive ahead of females to establish breeding territories. But now, that difference is becoming even more pronounced. It's unclear what kind of impact this change will have on bird populations, but it's a clear sign that climate change can affect female and male birds differently. And conservation efforts may need to account for those differences. Paying close attention to the birds enables us to help them the best way we can. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know you can listen to Bird Note in your podcast app? Subscribe to Bird Note Daily and never miss an episode.
Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
One of the best ways to prevent a tick bite is to apply a tick repellent before going outdoors. Although this seems like a simple solution, many people hesitate to make this a regular part of their routine. Two Canadian entrepreneurs are trying to change that and have developed a tick repellent for people and pets, as well as outdoor spaces like backyards, playgrounds, and even golf courses. Lisa Learning is an Indigenous entrepreneur who grew up in Labrador and is the founder of Atlantic Repellent Products. When Lisa wasn't satisfied with the synthetic tick repellents that were available for her family, she took matters into her own hands to create a natural botanical product for the Canadian market. Nancy Thompson is her business partner who coordinates the scientific research. We reached Lisa in Blockhouse, Nova Scotia, and Nancy is joining us from Squamish, British Columbia. Welcome to our podcast, Lisa and Nancy.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Well, let's start with you, Lisa, to learn more about the evolution of your business, and then we can dive into the science with Nancy. Lisa, how did you become interested in creating a tick repellent?
Well, I've been an entrepreneur pretty much my whole life, and I've had a variety of different types of businesses. But this came about from a personal situation. We moved to Mahone Bay, Nova Scotia, and a neighbor warned us about the ticks, but I didn't pay much attention to it because I didn't understand what ticks and Lyme and all that really was until my boys started getting swollen knees and swollen ankles. We took them to the hospital. It was a mystery. We didn't know what was going on. And then it got to the point where my oldest boy at the time, he was 11, he couldn't walk anymore because he was in so much pain So it was terrifying, because when you don't know what's going on and the doctors don't know what's going on, and then your son, who's only young, can't walk, you know, it was quite life altering. But luckily, we did end up finding out that it was Lyme, and they did get treated. But then I found out that you can get Lyme over and over again. So them being young boys and wanting to play outdoors, and me being a protective mom and, you know, wanting them to play, but I was a little scared. I started to look around for a tick repellent, and I didn't want to put DEET on them, but I couldn't find anything on the market that was natural and proven, a natural proven tick spray. So I didn't want to go to a farmer's market. There's lots there, and that nothing wrong with farmer's markets, but if there was no scientific evidence behind it, it was all anecdotal. So I just started doing my own research, and I don't have a science background, but you don't need a science background to read the research papers and the synapses and all that stuff. So that's what I started doing. And I figured out what essential oils repelled ticks the most from previous studies. Then I figured out what oils were best for your skin, et cetera. And I came up with my own formulas. I came up with three formulas originally. And then later on, I paired up with Acadia University, because while I'd done my own research, I'm not a scientist, and I needed that scientific, you know, background from somebody. So I paired up with Acadia University, and we started to work on tick sprays and explore different options and started studying ticks. And then that's about the time that Nancy and I hooked up again, because we're both from the same hometown and grew up together more or less, but we hadn't really talked in about 20 years.
Wow.
And Lyme brought us together, because Nancy gave me a call, and with Nancy's background